Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
All right, we are live on the internet with both video and audio. I'm Dave Rubin. This is the Rubin Report. We've got a Thursday panel extravaganza for you. And I should note, if I look a little worse for wear, I took a five-hour flight this morning from Savannah, Georgia, to right here. What? 5 hour, 5 a.m. Did I say 5 hours? See, there you go. 5 a.m. I've been up since 4 a.m. basically, okay? But here we are doing a show, and I brought in all-stars to help carry the weight. That was the point of all of this. I've got Winston Marshall from The Winston Marshall Show, very cleverly titled, and also joining me is evolutionary biologist, professor, and author of The Sad Truth About Happiness, 8 Secrets for Leading the Good Life, my old friend Gad Saad. Guys, welcome to the Rubin Report.
Hi, guys.
Having us.
First, before we begin, I told you guys that I just got glasses, and then Gad, you put on your glasses. Does this look like a very smart panel, or what, if we do it this way?
Oh, my.
It looks 20 times smarter. That's 20 times smarter. we look like morons without it. We'll try the best we can. Anyway, of course, we're going to talk about all this college campus craziness, then some stuff related to this immigration crisis, because apparently we're now going to let some Gazans into the U.S. And then we're going to end with actually something really interesting. Nayib Bukele, who is the president of El Salvador, we've played a bunch of videos of him over the last couple months. He is cracking down on government corruption in El Salvador in a major, major way. And maybe we could use a little bit of that over here. But before we get to any of that, I will let those guys rest for a moment and tell you guys about Gravity Defier Shoes. Guys, let me share a recent discovery with you. Gravity Defier Shoes, that's G-D-E-F-Y Shoes. Let me tell you, they're simply amazing. No, they're beyond amazing. G-Defy is a footwear company on a mission to relieve knee, back, and foot pain. Now, as many of you know, I've struggled with my knee from balling all these years, but the moment I slipped into my G-Defy shoes, the pain just vanished. How does G-Defy achieve this ultimate comfort? Firstly, every pair comes with free custom orthotics to align your body perfectly. Then there's their patented VersoShock trampoline technology in the heel, which absorbs harmful shocks and provides positive, renewed energy, empowering you to tackle your day. Additionally, G-Defy has integrated a strong structural system into their shoes that improves your posture and encourages you to walk using your calf and other major muscle groups. Don't take my word for it. Read the countless customer reviews raving about the pain relief and amazing comfort they've experienced with G-Defy shoes. I, for one, can't get enough of them, and I wholeheartedly recommend them to anyone looking for relief. Experience the comfort and pain relief for yourself. Visit gdefy.com today. Use code Rubin30 for $30 off $150 or more. And now back to me. Okay, so let's just dive right into what's been going on the college campuses. I want to tee this off with Tulsi Gabbard, who we had in here earlier in the week, and she seems quite amenable to being the vice president for a certain orange man. Well, she also went on Joe Rogan, as her book came out this week, and talked a bit about how different the reaction would be today from college students if we were to have a 9/11 compared to back then.
During the holiday of Passover, and this question came up about what would happen if another 9/11 style terrorist attack or some major incident like that came up in our country today. Would it have that same kind of unifying effect that occurred after that attack on 9/11? And when you look at things like that, like the Osama bin Laden letter, and you look at how there is, I mean, there's an entire, not an entire generation, but there's a lot of people now who I wouldn't be surprised if they said, well, you know, such an attack was justified, and not have that same kind of sense of unity of like, hey, no matter our differences, we got to stand together as Americans. And that should be a serious concern.
It should be a serious concern also when you really take into consideration how many genuinely dumb people there are. And when you have a situation like October 7th in Israel, I saw within days, before Israel did what they did in Palestine, within days, I saw people justifying the attacks on October 7th because of the treatment that Israel has given to the Palestinians. I'm like, hey, that's crazy. That's crazy. That's crazy to say that you think people should be indiscriminately shot and killed and just in mass at a fucking rave, like paratrooping. Yeah. You think that's okay because of what Israel's done. But guess what? Those people didn't do that.
Right.
Those people at the rave and those people that are on the border, those are apparently, according to Ari, those are the hippies.
Right.
They're the ones who want to be, they're the ones who don't believe that we should be
don't
there.
Believe in borders.
Yeah, they don't believe in borders.
Exactly.
They want to be close to the Palestinians. Which
right.
is,
exactly. And that's where, you know, some of the things that they're chanting that these protesters are chanting at Columbia University and some of the other ones. We hope that October 7th happens 10,000 times over, they say, you know, celebrating Hamas, this Islamist terrorist organization. I don't think we can just dismiss them as just being stupid. You know what I mean? Like, these kids are going to Ivy League schools. They are being absolutely manipulated, and there is a very intentional ideological war that is being waged in this example by these radical Islamist groups like Hamas, and they had planned this. They've been doing this for hundreds of years, and they're using technology and they're using other means to be able to achieve that end.
No doubt, as is Russia, as is China.
Okay, there's a few things we can unpack from that clip, but Gad, I want to start with you on this one because I was in New York during 9/11. I was about 25 years old. It is etched into my mind forever, the weeks and weeks and months after it, you know, having friends and family that couldn't get out of the city for a couple of days, staying at my place, going down there. I was on the Upper East Side. I mean, the smell of soot and smoke and debris for literally weeks, 90 blocks away, all the rest of it. But there was largely in America, but especially in New York City, a sense that we were going to come together. We had no choice, in essence. And I think Tulsi's completely right. It would be very different. You've been talking about a mind virus for quite some time, and I think this is directly connected to it, or a symptom of it.
Indeed. The late Canadian comic Norm Macdonald famously put out a tweet a few years ago before he passed away, where I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the tweet in front of me, where he said, you know, if Islamic terrorists were to detonate a nuclear bomb that killed 50 million people, it will be really important the day after to make sure that there isn't a rise in Islamophobia, right? So that's exactly what's happening today, right? And I don't mean, forgive the plug, but my next book is going to be titled Suicidal Empathy. It precisely speaks to that. When empathy is a great emotion to have, and there's an evolutionary reason why we are empathetic creatures. But when empathy is misdirected, when empathy is hyperactivated on the wrong target, you end up with public policies that are absolutely insane, right? So vets become less important than Guatemalans. I mean, American vets, the homeless become more important than the kids who should be able to play in parks without having, needles filled with the drugs. And so this is exactly what you're seeing now, is a slow erasure of the edifices of reason. And as you said, thank you for pointing it out, I've been talking about these parasitic ideological rapture for years now, and this is the outcome.
I should mention I have two international guests on the show today because Gad obviously up in Canada, and Winston, you're in New York at the moment, but you obviously are from the UK originally. Are you surprised how quickly these protests have become radically anti-American? I mean, for a couple weeks they were really focusing on Israel, and then suddenly it was death to America and burning American flags and the rest of it. I mean, you guys across the pond have your own problems as it pertains to this sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually would quite like to challenge both you, Dave, and something that Tulsi said, or maybe it's a small detail, but I think an important one. In 2001, with the 9/11, yes, you're right, there was general unifying in America, I sensed. But don't forget, people like Noam Chomsky, their reaction was, what did we do to them?
Yeah, we had it coming, sort of.
So this, and I think that was an early seed in what's been since then turbocharged by social media, turbocharged by ideological capture of the academy across the West in your countries and mine. And so this has been a long time in the making. It's not a complete 9/11 isn't so completely distant a world to what's going on right now. And I think Dr. Saad will have a better understanding being within the university himself. Before we're speaking, describing how even 20 years ago, his university was described as, Gaza?
Gaza University, yes.
Gaza University. So this isn't just a completely new thing. All that's happened is that there's been a complete takeover. That seems to be the big change.
Right. The other piece, of course, happens to be that there seem to be various groups that, if left unto themselves, would be killing each other, say Queers for Palestine, which is very different than Palestine for Queers, and the Marxists combined with the communists and the jihadists and now Antifa, and there are probably illegals there. And that gets us to the next clip here, because Eric Adams, who's obviously the mayor of New York City, was asked about the various groups that have been showing up to Columbia, because we just have no numbers on how many of these people are students in the first place.
I saw similar indicators from the Black Lives Matters March when it was brought to my attention that there were those who came to the city to disrupt our city, and she was able, through her team, was able to conduct an investigation, and what I feared was actually materialized and actualized by those who were on the ground. And I know that there are those who are attempting to say, well, the majority of people may have been students. You don't have to be the majority to influence and co-opt an operation. That is what this is about. And so if we want to play the word police, you could do so. I want to play the New York City police, where we're going to protect our city from those who are attempting to do what is happening globally. There is a movement to radicalize young people. And I'm not going to wait until it's done and all of a sudden acknowledge the existence of it. This is a global problem that young people are being influenced by those who are professionals at radicalizing our children. And I'm not going to allow that to happen as the mayor of the city of New York. So the men and women of the New York City Police Department, you should be proud of yourself.
Dad, I'm no fan of Eric Adams, and he made New York City a sanctuary city, so he ushered in much of this madness. He's been terrible on crime and a bunch of other stuff, but he did basically get that right. The question is, well, what are you going to do? You can say that, all right, the encampment's gone for now, but are you never going to allow it to happen again? How are you going to de-radicalize Columbia University and the rest of the institutions?
Yeah, I along those lines, I can't remember if it was in New York. Do you remember a day or two ago, there were some cops who were putting down the Palestinian flag and raising the American flag, and that caused a lot of people to feel a lot of positive emotions. Well, I actually took it the exact opposite way. The fact that we are today in a zeitgeist where raising the American flag on Americans, I mean, this is not Iwo Jima, right? This is not World War II, right? So the fact that people are celebrating that we are taking down the Palestinian flag speaks quite clearly to how weak and castrated Western leaders are. So notwithstanding what Eric Adams said here, which is a good thing, there needs to be that kind of reaction persistently over the long run if we are to autocorrect. Otherwise, I guarantee you it will be a slow demise into the abyss of infinite lunacy.
Right. I mean, Winston, it seems to me that that abyss of infinite lunacy that Gad's talking about is inevitable in certain places and certain institutions. I would say Columbia, it is inevitable at this point. But do you think there's anything they can really do in these cities that have been largely taken over by this? I mean, we all watched the Summer of Love in 2020 with BLM, and now they just ripped the mask off and put on a keffiyeh.
Well, there's a very curious change, because I agree that there's a lot of crossover in who it is that's on the streets. And there's a lot of crossover in the ideology, oppressor, oppressed. It fits very neatly together. But there are some curious differences. One of the big differences is the reaction from the establishment. In 2020, when 19 people were killed in the first 14 days of the BLM riots, when in the entire month of June 2020, the federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, was under siege and indeed under insurrection, the establishment ignored it. Biden said Antifa was just an idea. And what's slightly different now is that although they're still part of the establishment, people like AOC and the squad, or the quad, what do we call her? The quad.
I don't want to get demonetized, so I'm not going to say what I call her. But you can figure it out.
They're sort of taking a similar tack, but there's establishment Democrats, establishment elite, who are being a bit more critical and sort of seem to be supporting the police. And I'm curious by that difference. I'm not sure I fully understand it. I actually have a question for you both that I'm quite, seeing as we're talking about 2020 and those of us who spoke out against those, let's say the excesses of BLM, and the free speech issues that we faced, there's a curious line for me in this particular movement. And if I can point to what happened at the University of Texas, where 50 people were arrested, state police were sent in. It's a public university. It's not a private university like Columbia. And according to FIRE, who I do think are a very good free speech organization, these students, protesters, had not incited violence, had not broken the law. They were exercising free speech. Now, it's speech that I personally happen to hate. But where do we think it might have gone too far? Is there a concern that we're letting our principles go a little bit because we don't like what's being said? Do you guys have a take?
Yeah, it's a great question. Gad, why don't you take a stab
first? So I talk about in several of my writings about the difference between deontological and consequentialist ethics. So consequentialist ethics would be I take an action while looking at the consequences. So if your spouse says, do I look fat in those jeans, put on your consequentialist hat and say, of course you don't look fat because you want to stay married. On the other hand, freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, journalistic integrity, presumption of innocence are deontological statements, meaning that they are absolutes that cannot be violated for consequentialist calculus. So to answer Winston, look, I'm a free speech absolutist in that despite being Jewish with my personal history, I support the right of people to spew the most offensive things, which would be denying the Holocaust. But where I draw the line, to Winston's question, is if you go into any form of direct incitement to hate. So you could say Judaism is one big pyramid of crock, and that's perfectly fine. If you say, let's go on the corner of 7th and Broadway, where the Jews will be coming out of synagogue and beat them up, then we have a problem. So I'm very much of a free speech absolutist as long as it doesn't cross that line.
The only thing I would add to that would be that I think partly what's going on here isn't directly about speech. So I think they're intentionally using phrases like river to the sea to get as close to inciting violence as possible. I'm not for jailing people for doing it, but I think they're playing a linguistic game with all of us because they know what they're saying. They know how it's being received, but they're not just saying kill 8 million Jews, right? So that's one part of it. But the other part is as it pertains to property. And I think that's I don't know the specifics of what happened at University of Texas?
The distinction is that the University of Texas is a state-owned property, whereas Columbia is private-owned. So I would say they have the legal right to even encamp there. They don't have the legal right to destroy the property like what's happened in this present in Oregon, in University of Portland, Antifa doing their usual nonsense.
I'm not fully aware of Texas's laws as it pertains to that, but you can't just endlessly take over even a public space and then not allow certain people in and vandalize it and everything else. So I don't know the specifics as it pertains to that. But otherwise, if we just say, okay, it's okay, whatever your cause is, you can go to any public space and take it over whenever you want and for as long as you want, we will have no public spaces. That really is the problem, I think. But let me jump to another one more clip on this, because here's Deputy Commissioner Tarek Shepard from the New York City Police Department showing that perhaps there are elements involved that aren't as innocent as some, you know, confused genderqueer sophomore at Columbia.
Tell us about this change.
Yeah, so when we entered Hamilton Hall, this is not what students bring to school. Okay, this is
what
professionals bring to campuses and universities. These are heavy industrial chains that were locked with bike locks.
Wow.
And this is what we encountered on every door inside of Hamilton Hall. And so in order for our emergency services group to enter into the building, they had to first cut through these chains, but also get rid of debris and barricaded doors that were barricaded with refrigerators, vending machines, chairs, you name it. They pushed it up against those doors to try and stop us from coming in. But our guys would not be stopped. They did a fantastic job of entering into that location and taking people into custody without incident last night. They took about 40 to 50 people into custody inside of the lobby of Hamilton Hall last night.
The reason I wanted to show that clip is because when the New York City Police Department is given the ability or is given the go-ahead to do the things it's supposed to do, it still is able to do it. Guy Benson retweeted that clip and he had a good comment on it, I thought. He said, it's a collaboration between radical paid agitators and radical students. The former should be arrested and charged. The latter should be arrested and expelled. Winston, since the UK has a more long-going, more ongoing problem with some, let's say, Islamist elements, is there something that perhaps you guys should have done 10 years ago at university or elsewhere that maybe we should look into right now?
Well, our problems have been twofold. We've had the same similar university issues that you have guys have had, but one thing that's a little bit different is our immigration situation, which I think is something we'll come on to speaking more later. But I would say that one of the, let's say, aspects of the current protests in the UK that's different from, let's say, the BLM protests that we also had was that there's a lots of my Muslim groups represented in them. There's a recent poll that Henry Jackson Society put out that 76% of British Muslims don't believe that October 7th happened. One in 100 British Muslims are on MI5 jihad watch list, and that's about 3.9. There's 3.9 to 4 million Muslims in the UK, and one in 100 are on that list. So we have a serious issue of Islamism. Maybe that's not quite what you're getting at with your pointing at the university, but there's a kind of a combination of phenomena happening at the same time.
Let me jump to the next clip, Gad, because it's an offshoot of what Winston's talking about there. So the Biden administration apparently is considering a plan to allow an unknown amount of Gazans into America. Take a look.
This news exclusively on CBS News. The Biden administration is considering a plan to allow some Palestinian refugees to come here to the United States. That's according to internal federal government documents that were obtained by CBS's Camilo Montoya Galvez. According to the plan, some Palestinians fleeing the war would be offered a permanent safe haven here in the U.S. And one option under consideration is to allow those who have immediate family members who are either American citizens or permanent residents to enter the country if they pass various background checks first. The plans would require coordination with Egypt, which has so far refused to allow large numbers of people from Gaza to cross the border into that country.
Gad, there's so much here. I mean, first off, we've let in, the common number is that we've let in 7 million illegals in the last 3 years. I heard RFK Jr. say 10 million a couple of days ago. So somewhere between, let's say, 7 and 10 million. We have no idea what these people believe or anything else. But in Gaza specifically, obviously there are good Gazans, but their entire education system has been about teaching about killing the Jews and hating the West. I suspect you don't think this is the best idea, and perhaps you'll take some more in Canada. Would that be cool?
Yeah, I hope not. But let me break that. You're exactly right that there's a lot to discuss here. So number one, I might get some of the numbers wrong, so forgive me. I may be off by 1 or 2%. So there was a Pew study conducted several years ago across many Islamic countries where they asked people, their level of Jew hatred, and typically it varied from 95 to 99% of the polled people. Now imagine for a second.
You might be off by a percent or two.
Exactly. So in the Palestinian territories, I think it was in the high 90s. Now let's put in another number. I think in the last, in the recent study that was done where they found that 73% of Gazans supported Hamas and what they did and so on, right? So it's not a small minority. It's not one in 100, which itself would be problematic because how do you know how to vet what's in someone's heart or someone's mind, right? It's not just if they are terrorists that they're dangerous. When they're coming into your country, what is the cultural and religious baggage that they're coming with? So it's absolutely insane. It's exactly what suicidal empathy is all about, right? And so Isaac Newton famously in his Newtonian mechanics talked about every action has a reaction. So here is the reaction that the West has taken. You can go in, butcher 1,200, 1,300 people, rape them and decapitate them. And the end result of that is some of you guys who fully support that action will be granted permanent citizenship in the United States. But when Professor Gatzad has to come to give a talk, they actually put me aside for 45 minutes to really vet me. So Gatzad has a hard time getting in, but Gazans will be given immediate permanent residence. Sounds like a good idea.
Top that, Winston.
Well, there are, just to add some nuance, there are regions of the Arabic world which have a very favorable viewing of America. Kurdistan, the Sunni Muslim region of northern Iraq, for example, has an 80% approval rating of America, which is higher than America has of itself. And so there are regions that it would be okay, but you can rest assured that if you're from Gaza, you are not going to be pro-American. And so importing them, or importing rather, allowing them come in is a very peculiar decision. But then one has to ask, why is Biden saying this? Is he trying to appeal to his left flank, who are very pro-Palestinian, who frankly aren't going, this isn't going to do anything for them. They're so angry about what's happening in Gaza that are saying that some refugees are going to come over. I just don't, it seems like a bizarre. Is it for the election? I don't know if you guys have any insight why he would even bother saying
so. Yeah, I think you could just be importing new voters, which is largely what I think is exactly what they're doing with the border right now. You could send a whole bunch of Somalis to Minnesota or to Minneapolis.
They're calling him Genocide Joe at the moment. They don't like him. This is one thing that's quite interesting seeing now the protests is that both the left and the right hate Joe Biden because they both have their problems with him because of this war.
Thank God he doesn't know who he is or he'd be depressed. Let me show you a little bit about what happens when illegals get to America. This was taken at the San Diego airport in the last day or two. They get a special line.
The illegals at San Diego airport get their own line to check in because they don't have the proper documentation to show. They're being flown around the country on our tax dollars.
Gad, is the West basically at the point where we see these videos, we know that none of this makes sense, that none of it works, that virtually nobody's going to stand up against it, at least in this current administration, and there's not much, other than exposing it, I don't know what we can really do. I mean, the states are trying to do some stuff as it pertains to immigration, but it's not even the job of the states, it's the job of the federal government, who are suing them in the Supreme Court about that right now.
Well, I'd like to be always optimistic, notwithstanding the dire reality that we're facing. And so I think that a cataclysmic leader, one who really is willing to make change, and I guess in the last block we'll be talking about one such leader in El Salvador. I think that's one of the reasons why people are so afraid of Orange Man, right? Because he is someone who is willing to take drastic, unpopular, unprogressive positions. So I think things can be turned around. We also have the silent majority who completely agrees that these are insane policies, but they're too afraid to speak out. I mean, I get thousands of these emails that come my way that say, hey, I support you, but I'm too afraid to say that I support what you're saying. So I think if you couple a very courageous leader with somehow igniting the spine and the testicular fortitude of the silent majority, I think this could still be turned around.
Well, I hate to blackpill you here, but I've got a clip from Hamburg, Germany, where hundreds of Islamists were chanting for a global caliphate and basically for Germany and the rest of the West to fail. Winston, this is happening kind of all over the West. It's happening in your country. We're seeing bits of it in Canada right now. It's just going to keep going, huh?
It's very upsetting. Very upsetting for me. We've seen similar things in my country, in Britain. It's almost every weekend since October 7th that we've had anti-Israel protests on the streets of London. I'm genuinely concerned about the future of the country. And in our country, no one has been doing anything about mass migration. We have 700,000 net migrants mm-hmm. a year. And that's under a conservative government who are pretending to at least claim they care about the issue. We're about to have a Labour government that's I don't know how it'd be possible, but I'm pretty confident they're going to be even worse than the Tories, who have been dreadful. We're trapped by political correctness because we can all see this. We can all see what's going on. We can mm-hmm. see these things, but mm-hmm. no one has the courage to speak out. And if you do have the courage, as Dr. Saad said, someone like Trump, Orange Man, has the courage to say what the rest of the elites and the rest of the establishment are too hamstrung by political correctness to say. Well, at least there's someone saying something. But this is very concerning. We're not talking about assimilation or integration. There's mm-hmm. no attempt for that as well. In fact, even those words are seen considered offensive because it's taken to mean that your culture isn't good enough. But this is how countries fall. This is how countries fail. This is a completely tearing at social cohesion. And the future is very bleak. I'm actually more optimistic about America than Europe. You'll have more insight.
Well, actually, so then let me ask you both the same question, because Gad, what would you say to our left-leaning or liberal, whatever liberal movement still remains in America, the people who get all of this, they see all of it, perhaps they do podcasts about it and everything else, but they will refuse to vote for Trump or will not publicly support Trump or anything else, when I'm completely in agreement with you that he's the one guy at this point that can do anything about this and then can maybe awaken that silent majority. Otherwise, I think we are done, and I'm not a pessimist at all.
I think the regrettable part is that many people don't see reality until it literally is at the doorstep of their home, right? Diabetes doesn't exist because I don't have diabetes, right? And take someone like Bill Ackman, whom I really appreciate what he's doing today, but mm-hmm. yes. Bill Ackman only woke up when it affected him personally, in that mm-hmm. it was his beloved alma mater that was being affected, and it was a Jewish issue. But prior to that, Bill Ackman seemed to have been completely unaware of all those realities. So that's the conundrum that I think is not just a problem of the progressives. It's enmeshed within the architecture of the human mind. I don't see it. I don't believe it's relevant until it comes to my door. If I could just add one more quick thing sure. about the general mass immigration. So as you probably both know, my mother tongue is Arabic. So mm-hmm. I speak to people who are from those cultures. I mean, now it's a bit harder because they usually recognize me. But in the past, when I would speak to them, here is what they would say to me in Arabic. The West is a woman to be mounted, right? And in Arabic, there are much more vulgar terms to use for that, mm-hmm. you know, euphemism, if you'd like. That's how they view the West. So all of the traits that we consider virtuous in the West, magnanimity, compassion, endless empathy, kindness, what is read by those folks is weakness, 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 and weakness. So until you have Western leaders that actually speak the cultural language mm-hmm. of the people that we are engaging, we're just going to be repeating the same mistakes over and over again.
Right. I can imagine a Hamas guy in a tunnel somewhere getting a video feed of some genderqueer weirdo at Columbia chanting their slogans, laughing hysterically. Like, you do get beheaded, too. But Winston, let me ask you the same question, because you mentioned Bill Ackman, so there's Coleman Hughes, Barry Weiss, Bill Maher. That liberal set that fully get it, and I think they deserve credit even if they're late to the party for getting it, but still are basically saying we won't vote for Trump. Is there anything that can be done to fix that? Because otherwise, if we don't get them, we're just ushering in more of this.
It was absolutely clear to me about I was living in New York from 2016 through to the pandemic, and there was a lot of talk about BLM and white privilege and all these things. It's absolutely clear to me at that point that anti-Semitism was the logical outcome of that ideology, and I argued in vain about those things. And you're right, now a lot of those, I would say you mentioned Coleman. I think he was very aware of this all along. Bill Ackman's a good example of someone who is part of an, I would say, a Jewish progressives who had got, you know, had supported some of these movements in the past and saw now, oh wow, this is actually, they realized what had, what this is.
But how do we was, how do we get them to shift electorally, if you think that that is the correct estimation, as Gad is laying out, and I agree with, how do you get them to actually shift, not just see it? I'm giving them all the credit for that. And by the way, we don't have to make it about any of those people specifically, just someone of that mindset.
Well, what makes you think they're not going to vote for Trump? I think a lot of people are voting for Trump. And in fact, just to your earlier point, and this applies to the border as well, you can see this in minority groups now are shifting towards Trump. His ratings are going up to that way. If you're talking about electorally, in fact, yeah, the combination of the immigration problem, as well as what we're seeing on campuses and the huge rise in anti-Semitism, this is actually helping Trump, it seems.
Yeah, no, I agree with that with the general population. I'm talking about this, that sort of liberal sliver. I'd love to see some of those people, say an Ackman or Barry or Coleman Hughes, et cetera, actually just say it. So they've left me with no choice, right?
The reason they're not saying that they would support Trump, I think some of them are going to vote for Trump. I think the reason they're saying it is because even in the alt media class that a lot of these people are in, it is still not okay. It's a little gauche, it's a little off to say that. It puts people off, and I think people are playing a game. I don't think people are totally open when they have strategic reasons to not be completely open.
That was the answer that I was going for. See, Gad, but we still have friends, right? It's still okay on this side.
Indeed. By the way, one of the things that defines a historic figure is someone who is not a fence sitter and who is a honey badger, meaning that they go like this when it comes to worrying about other people's opinions. So I don't have much sympathy for the folks who want to vote for Trump but won't, because they won't be accepted to the right cocktail parties. To me, they are castrated cowards, and I hold zero empathy or sympathy for them.
But how do you really feel? All right, I want to end with one other clip, because if there is a political solution to any of this, and I think that's a big if, we are going to need some more serious politicians. There is a guy down in El Salvador who just won re-election. It's President Nayib Bukele, who took El Salvador from quite literally being the most dangerous country on earth to making it one of the safest countries on earth. And here, check this out. It's in Spanish, but here he is talking to his entire parliament. He brings them in to announce that he's investigating all of them. This is wild.
Como pueden ver ustedes todos, los que estamos aquí reunidos son parte del ejecutivo, del órgano ejecutivo, que es el que del cual yo estoy encargado, a excepción de una persona. Es el fiscal general que está aquí. Él no es del ejecutivo. Y está acá por una razón bien sencilla. Y es porque le quiero pedir en público de que investiguemos a todos los que están acá. Para atrás y para adelante. Yo me imagino que pues no hay ningún problema, ¿no? Hay una persona que me dijo una vez, mire, y tú no le temes a la muerte. Yo le dije, no, pues claro, nadie se quiere morir. Yo no me quiero morir, pero yo sé que me voy a morir algún día, como todos. Si hay algo que no se puede escapar es de la muerte. Todos los que estamos aquí en... Pues en 100 años pues, no va a haber nadie vivo, nadie, ninguno de los que estamos aquí, ni, pero más probable es que nadie sabe cómo se llama el papá del abuelo de uno. Pero hay algo que yo sí le tengo miedo, y es a dejar un mal legado. Y hay presidentes, unos presos, otros fugitivos, pero la mayoría son recordados como ladrones. Yo no quiero ser recordado como el ladrón. Entonces yo no robo, porque no quiero ser recordado como el ladrón o el corrupto. Pero hubo un presidente, el presidente Duarte, que la gente decía en ese entonces, el presidente no es ladrón, pero se rodeó de ladrones.
All right, so for those of you that don't speak Spanish, quick recap. He brings in the entire executive branch, says, hey, this is the attorney general. He's looking at all of you, what you've done retroactively and in the future in terms of corruption. And then really the heartfelt part of what he says is, I'm not afraid of death. We're all going to die. But what I am afraid of is losing my legacy. And that's why I don't steal, et cetera, et cetera. Gad, I thought this was just a wonderful clip. It's not to say that everything he does is perfect, and I'm not an expert in El Salvadorian politics, but putting some people on notice. It feels like none of our politicians in the West feel like they're on notice, and they can trade above the market 10 times and all of the stuff that we all know, and that nobody does anything about the corruption. Like, it's now a feature rather than a bug. So I was pretty impressed by this.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to the earlier point that I raised regarding a cataclysmic leader, right? And it speaks to the issue of actions have reactions, right? People understand the natural law of consequences. But if you see now it's amazing that we live in a world today where El Salvador is the model of lack of political corruption, and right, where the United States and Canada are the old El Salvador. Up is down, freedom is slavery. It's insane. He does seem to be quite refreshing. Like you, I don't know much about the internal machinations of El Salvadorian politics, but he certainly seems like the real deal.
Winston, what would it take for us to get more leaders like this in the West? I mean, I guess there's a little bit of it happening across Europe right now, perhaps. But you just said in your country, you feel that it's going to get worse electorally.
In my country, politicians don't fear their legacy. They don't fear God. They don't even really fear the people. They fear two things. They fear losing their jobs, and they fear the newspaper headlines the day after. It's a total disaster, and it's exactly why our country is going down the shitter. And I'm very upset about how that. Now, in America, Dr. Saad rightly points out that it's all upside down. What I'm concerned about, and in that clip, he talks about bribery and these people being investigated for bribery. One thing that endlessly makes me frustrated is that every year $2 billion is spent in lobbying in D.C. What is that if not legitimized bribery? What, in 2020, Pfizer spent $10 million on lobbying D.C. and saw over $10 billion in profit. What is that if not legitimized bribery? It's the same in Europe, the EU. There's €1 billion spent every single year lobbying Brussels. How can these people how can these politicians work for the people and at the same time take these packets? There's a corruption that's been legitimized across the West, and it's part of this massive decay. We've got decay from the bottom, as we discussed at the beginning of this conversation. So we're seeing in the ideological corruption of our children and our students, and we've got decay at the top with all the politicians working as they are. There's a lot to be frightful, and it's about time people with courage stood up.
Gad, I can't let us leave on a frightened note, even though there was a little bit of hope right there at the end, Winston, about standing up, since you wrote a book on happiness. Give us the ultimate white pill for all, because a lot of this stuff is depressing. We're watching a lot of things collapse right now. We're seeing things in our countries that we know are not right. We're trying to wake people up. How do you stay happy throughout all of it?
Well, part of it, about 50% of your happiness score stems from your genes. That's innate. But the good news is that there's another 50% up for grabs. So the types of decisions that I make, the mindsets that I adopt, can either move me up the happiness summit or down. Two important decisions, because I know we're short on time. Choose the right spouse to wake up next to at the start of the day, and then have a job that provides you purpose and meaning, and you've cracked much of the code of happiness.
Wow. Well, then I think the three of us did okay.
Exactly.
Guys, I appreciate your time as always. We'll link to your stuff right down below, and we've got a post-game show at rubinreport.locals.com. In about 30 seconds. See you tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Be sure to subscribe and rate this podcast. And don't forget, you can watch my direct messages live on Blaze TV and YouTube every weekday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. And of course, if you want to connect with me personally and get early access to my sit-down interviews, join rubinreport.locals.com.